Ferguson, Missouri, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, all places where white police officers on duty shot and killed African-American young men, and all incidents that have prompted protests and national debate. So my thanks to Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, for talking about all the issues raised by these incidents. Jim, welcome to Wisconsin Eye.
Thank you for having me on.
Explain, first of all, the nature of the Wisconsin Police Professional Police Association. Who do you represent, sir?
Sure. Well, the WPPA is the state's largest law enforcement group. We represent nearly 10,000 members from all across the state, from about just short of 300 local association affiliates. And so there are a few exceptions, like the city of Milwaukee, which has always been independent, but we do represent most of the local law enforcement officers, police officers, and sheriff's deputies.
How many officers?
Nearly 10,000 members.
Nearly 10,000. Officer-involved fatal shootings have been in the news more than ever recently, especially those in which a white officer shoots an African-American. Is this a matter of we're seeing more of these incidents, or are roughly the same number of incidents being covered in new and more expansive ways by the media, Jim?
I think it's more of the latter. I mean, part of the problem is that, as you may know, there's no state agency or national agency, federal agency, that collects data on the number of officer-involved shootings and officer-related deaths. We've always tracked the number that we're involved with each year. Last year, we started keeping a statewide tally. Just by way of example, last year there were 23 officer-involved shootings statewide, mm-hmm. and we represented members in 17 of those.
23 officer-involved shootings. How many of those were fatal, sir?
I believe 8 or 9 of those were fatal. I don't recall specifically, but
are we talking calendar 2014?
Correct.
Have you done a look back to see how that number varies? Is it up more over the last 5 years?
We haven't, because prior to 2014, we only collected the number of shootings that our members were involved in. 2010 was a banner year, if there is such a thing, not in a good way. We did have almost 30 officer-involved shootings that year, just that we were involved in. So I would imagine, obviously, that agencies like Milwaukee had a good number of their own.
Well, you have been a part of this debate in Wisconsin to an extent that I don't think you imagined when 2015 came in, correct?
No, not really. I mean,
has it been difficult for you?
In some ways it has. It's been challenging. Last year we were very much involved in advocating and supporting a new law that mandates the independent and transparent investigations of officer-involved shootings. It's first law of its kind in the country.
Right. So your organization fought for that law, which is
correct.
Now the law.
That is correct.
And the issue is, how many FTEs should the Department of Justice get to be devoted directly to that?
Right.
And that's a
correct.
Funding issue that will be addressed in the budget.
It is, and it sounds like there's some progress being made on that, and we've been reaching out to lawmakers as well. I think the Attorney General has requested 5 additional positions,
yes.
and I think he'll get some additional help.
Okay.
To what extent, it's too early to tell.
Why did you and your organization and others push for Wisconsin to have this first law, Jim?
Well, I think we recognize that it was a perception issue, clearly. And we want the jobs that law enforcement officers do and the investigations into their conduct to be credible. And in order to do that, it was important for an independent investigation to occur. In fact, it was the most prevalent way that approach that agencies use around the state. And there are just some outliers, some larger law enforcement agencies in particular that had the expertise and the history and the personnel and historically had always done those. And it was just, the public credibility in garnering and maintaining the public trust is fundamentally important to the jobs that our law enforcement officers have to do. So we thought it was an important law. We were glad to be a part of it.
Did you anticipate the racial nature of this debate, Jim?
Not really. I mean, obviously there have been some, incidents and police controversies around the country that have really drawn attention to this aspect. And obviously, going into leading back to your first question, I think that has, really increased the public scrutiny around these incidents wherever they occur.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Are these incidents covered fairly by the news media? Because you've got the New York City, in addition to Ferguson, in addition to Milwaukee, in addition to Madison. How do you and the officers you represent feel about the news coverage?
Well, I think law enforcement officers are at a disadvantage. I mean, obviously, we're not going to talk about facts that are under investigation, and that's out of respect for the independent and transparent process. And so, automatically, police officers that are involved in these situations are put at a disadvantage. I think any law enforcement officer recognizes that they're held to a higher level of scrutiny, a higher standard, because of the authority that they exercise to keep us safe. But it can be challenging. I mean, the media can be quick to characterize and paint in broad strokes an incident. And we saw some of that in the most recent shooting here in Madison, which is why we try to take a more proactive role and highlight the distinctions between Madison, Wisconsin, and Ferguson, Missouri, because we think there are quite a few. But at the same time, again, we're at a disadvantage. We have to respect the investigatory process. There are going to be other people in the public and in the media. They're going to, they're going to speculate. We're left at somewhat of a disadvantage and can't respond to those things.
Well, you mentioned Madison and Ferguson. Why didn't Madison, thankfully, have the level of violence that was seen in Ferguson? Why was the response different in Madison, Wisconsin than Ferguson, Missouri?
Sure. Well, I think there are a number of things. Most prominently, I think, the Madison Police Department has really dedicated itself over many years to community-oriented policing and developing relationships with all members and all contingencies in the community. So that's a big part of it. Also, as you may recall, police department in Ferguson is not representative of the community it serves.
I think 3 of 64 officers.
Right. I think there's
minority.
A 55 percentage point disparity between the number of officers, white officers, that they have in the department, and those that they serve in the community. Whereas in Madison, it is much more representative. I think there's only a 4.1 percentage point difference. And so, I think Madison has done a very good job at recruiting a more diverse workforce, and has really stressed the importance of working and developing relationships with the various communities in the city.
Which leads me to a training question. Are Wisconsin police officers trained in the same way to respond to, traffic stops and these other incidents? Is there a disparity between Milwaukee, our largest community, and the smallest rural area of Wisconsin?
I don't know that there are. The statewide standards and policy, that govern how officers approach these situations and, the use of force and things like that are very standard not only in Wisconsin but throughout the country. Wisconsin also has, just in the last few years, expanded the number of hours that are required for officers, the training that's required for them to become officers. And that includes, cultural competence training. And that's something I think is more unique, and we're going to see that become more prevalent, thankfully, and I think rightfully, across the country.
Put us in the, help me understand the role of a police officer responding to some of these incidents. Let me preface it this way. A very good friend of mine who just retired after 30 years in law enforcement once told me that he had like 2/3 of a second to decide whether to fire a weapon or not.
Right.
Put me in the shoes of some of these officers responding to some of these very difficult situations.
Well, officers, they confront a wide variety of situations and even, a situation that may appear innocuous. They know from their experience and their training can turn deadly in, as you mentioned, a fraction of a second. And so they have to be prepared, and their training kicks in. Every time we talk to officers that have been involved in these high-profile incidents involving the use of force, they always describe how their training takes over. And I think that is a testament to the degree of training that they get in Wisconsin. But you're right, they have to make split-second life and death decisions. And the law recognizes that, obviously, and does give them some discretion in terms of the authority that they exercise.
So the officer in the city of Milwaukee receives the same amount of training on some of these instances as the smallest sheriff's department in the state of Wisconsin, correct?
Correct. There are statewide standards that govern this, absolutely. Now, the individual, there are some disparities, and I shouldn't say disparities, distinctions, in the sense that local law enforcement agencies do each year, they control and dictate, the training that their individual officers get.
Mm-hmm.
There are some standards like defense and arrest tactics and firearms training and things of that nature that are standard and have to be, revisited and retrained every single year. But otherwise, in many ways, the law enforcement community and the profession is reactive in the sense that, situations arise, we try as a profession and as a community to learn from them, and then you provide training to the officers to help avoid or learn from those situations in the future.
As you've talked to some of your members in light of these recent incidents, are they doing anything differently? Has it forced them to reassess their jobs and these instantaneous responses that they must make?
I hope not, and I don't think so. Officers, when we talk to them, and we talk to a lot of them, we have more experience as an organization, that is the WPPA, in these high-profile officer-involved shootings than any other organization or even agency in the state. We were involved in 17 of 23 incidents last year, and there was no agency that investigated that many. And as I mentioned, when officers are involved in these situations, their training kicks in. And so That's fortunate. I think that won't deviate or create any kind of deviation in how they respond to incidents. But that is a concern for us that, you know, as they see, you know, their colleagues across the state and across the country subject to such public scrutiny and in some ways vilified in the public. We don't want them to hesitate necessarily because it could, you know, pose a greater risk to their lives and their safety and that of those around them.
Well, speak for 10,000 members. If they could send a message to people who have been reading about this news coverage, what's the message of your 10,000 members in the wake of these recent incidents?
Sir? Sure. Well, I think, you know, it's probably twofold if I had to pick some the most prominent themes. One, that, you know, the use of force is a complicated topic. A lot of people have an idea that there's a continuum, a use of force continuum, that officers, you know, it's a general guideline that officers utilize very stringently in Wisconsin. But, the reasonableness of their conduct when it comes to use of force is really dictated by the circumstances. And so it's not the case that an officer confronts every situation with the lowest amount of force necessary. That's just not how they're trained. And that's not something that we think would protect their lives and the lives of others. The other thing is, sometimes we think, our members think, and I hear this a lot, that that, you know, they're a good contingent of the public, and certainly the media doesn't respect the jobs that they do and the risks that they confront, and you know, that there's a lot of Monday morning kind of quarterbacking that goes on, and then, you know, at the same time, like I said earlier, they recognize that that's the public's right. I mean, to raise questions and express concerns. So there's kind of this, you know, internal conflict about, you know, people having this right and exercising this right to express those concerns, but at the same time, maybe not understanding the jobs that our officers have. And so that's an educational challenge, and that's one I think that the law enforcement profession, not only in Wisconsin but nationally, has to do a better job of communicating with the public in terms of use of force practices. And I think that is something that's going to improve. And even President Obama's 21st Task Force on 21st Century Policing has stressed the need to improve community relations and to, you know, evaluate training. And you're going to see things like body cameras that they're going to become more prevalent throughout the Wisconsin as well as the rest of the country.
Well, let's go to cameras. Would is one possible answer every officer who is on patrol wearing a camera? What's the benefit of that and what's the downside of that? Because you and I have heard the critics saying you're potentially invading the privacy of some domestic assault victims, but go ahead.
Right. Well, as an organization, we support body cameras, and we understand that they're coming. But at the same time, it's incumbent upon us to point out that there are some shortcomings. And, you know, I mentioned that the President's Task Force, and it even acknowledged that body cameras are not a panacea to some of the issues that we're confronting nationally as it relates to law enforcement conduct. And there are privacy concerns. And they're going to, you know, these things will have to be dealt with, I think, at the local level in terms of, you know, to what extent an officer has discretion when they turn it on and when they turn it off, to what extent those recordings are, you know, available for public inspection.
Well, pursuing the body camera issues, do you think an officer should decide when to turn it on and turn it off? Because then you get a little bit into the Hillary Clinton, I deleted only the personal emails type issues.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not touching that one.
But, I understand.
Right. We think they should have discretion. I mean, certainly there should be some guidelines as to, you know, when they, you know, when they can exercise that discretion. But, you know, if they're, you know, speaking with a confidential informant, if they're in their squad car and they need to type in a key code to get, you know, access their computer, or, you know, I mean, they're, or if they're discussing with other officers, you know, the details of a tactical operation that they're about to commence. I mean, those are things that I think the public would, probably agree that, you know, there's not a lot of public value in releasing them. In fact, they may create a public safety danger. But at the same time, we expect that they're coming, and we support that. We just think it has to be done delicately and thoughtfully.
How much do body cameras cost, and who should pay for those, Jim?
That's a good question, and they are expensive. The body cameras themselves aren't as expensive as is the cost of the storage. And that's where, if you talk to law enforcement experts across the country, they'll say, I mean, that's really where there's a considerable cost. And local communities, I think, are going to have to decide, you know, they're going to have to balance, you know, that as a priority. And you know, is it more important that officers are equipped with body cameras, or, you know, is it going to be a choice between body cameras and bulletproof vests? I mean, and obviously we want our officers to be safe. A lot of people don't know that bulletproof vests have a limited lifespan, and they wear out, and even if they're not hit with a bullet. And so it really is going to be something that local communities are going to have to evaluate in terms of to what extent it's a priority for them. We expect it'll be done thoughtfully, hopefully. It's definitely an emerging technology that's going to become more prevalent.
Do you wish the officer involved in Tony Robinson's shooting would have been wearing a body camera?
That's a good question. I haven't actually considered that. I think it would only help if a body camera had been he had been wearing a body camera in this case. I think there was a lot of obviously physical evidence, and there'll be evidence from neighbors and other witnesses that heard or saw different aspects of what occurred, and I think they'll support his accounting of what occurred. But a body camera would have been very helpful.
DOJ, as you know, has just delivered all of its reports on the Robinson shooting to the Dane County DA. But you've been involved in this incident. Do you think that officer acted properly?
I wouldn't want to comment necessarily. I'm trying to stay away from commenting on the details of it. What I can tell you about Officer Kenny is he's a consummate professional. We released his personnel record, although he was under no obligation to do so.
Which I was so intrigued, and that was one of the reasons I'm so glad you came in here.
Sure.
You not only you saw to it that his personnel record was made public,
right?
And he was commended, I think, 12 times in the course of his career.
I think it was 47 times.
Though. 47 times.
Right.
Thanks for the correction.
Yeah.
You also released the results of his blood test, showing that there was nothing in there.
Right.
There was no alcohol. There were no
right.
drugs. Why did it fall to you to release that and not the Madison Police Chief?
Well, typically what the protocol is that the Madison Police Department wouldn't release that until the investigation is complete and the district attorney makes a decision. That's what they've done in the past. Officer Kenny and I discussed it, and he felt it was important to be as transparent as possible without getting into the specific details of his use in force encounter. And he thought that that was an important part of the situation, and as was his, not only did we release his personnel file, but his pre-employment file as well.
Yes, he was with the Coast Guard.
He was with the Coast Guard, and if you look at that, it even included the essays that he wrote as part of the application process, and he talks at length about his respect for people of all cultures. I mean, he really is an extraordinary officer, we're confident that, we're confident that he acted appropriately, but obviously, there's an investigation that's ongoing, we'll wait for that determination by the DA.
You've talked to him. He's not available to the news media, which I can understand. Tell me about his mood.
Well, I think any officer that's involved in a situation like this, it's a terribly stressful time for them and their families. But he's also mindful of the fact that a family has suffered a tragic loss, and that is the Tony Robinson family. And so that's something that weighs on him. So not only does the fact that a family has suffered a loss of a loved one, not only does that weigh on him, but the fact that he has this investigation, and it's going to take some time. While the investigation is complete, I'm sure we expect the district attorney's review to take a significant amount of time.
He was involved in another shooting, but he was exonerated in that.
Mm-hmm.
Does his involvement in two shootings, does he want to go back to being a patrol officer?
He does. He believes his sole purpose in life is to serve and protect others. And even before he was in the Coast Guard, he was a lifeguard. And so, this is really part of who he is and his identity. And I think he is very eager to get back to serving the people of this community. And, even though he's been involved in another shooting, as you mentioned, in 2007, he's been involved in a wide variety of incidents that have earned him acclaim. And he's well decorated. And even situations that didn't rise to the level of use of force and perhaps could have. It's unusual to see an officer that has, over the course of especially a 12-year career in the case of Officer Kenny, that has no citizen complaints waged against him. That's unusual. I mean, officers, you always have, they always deal with people who maybe don't like, they're unhappy about a traffic stop or something like that. And mm-hmm. obviously there are others that may be more legitimate, but it's uncommon. And again, that we just think that speaks to who he is, and that's part of his story that we wanted to get out there in releasing those records and his toxicology.
Chief Koval, who's Wisconsin I has interviewed, he was very visible in this process.
Mm-hmm.
At first, he expressed sorrow to Tony Robinson's family. Then he criticized the Madison Common Council for not standing up for the police department. Was his criticism of the Common Council justified, Jim?
Well, I'd first point out that I think that Chief Koval's reaction is yet another distinction between what has occurred in Madison, Wisconsin, and that which occurred in Ferguson, Missouri.
Okay.
And I think that level of sensitivity, not only from Chief Koval, but from the law enforcement community, expressing sensitivity and for the fact that a family has suffered a tragic loss, I think is important. And it was the right thing to do, and not something that you've seen occur in some of these other high-profile incidents, whether it be in New York or in Ferguson, Missouri, or elsewhere. So I think that's an important thing to add in terms of the distinctions between Madison and Ferguson. As to his criticisms of the Common Council, I think he was expressing the frustration that he feels in terms of, I think in that particular City Council meeting, he felt what he wrote, that some members of the community were given a platform to say whatever they want, and he was frustrated that he couldn't, had no ability to respond. And our officers, would share that, I think, especially in Madison. I've talked to numerous officers who, provided security for the scene of the Tony Robinson shooting. Mm-hmm. And they had protesters and people even just walking by, calling them racists and murderers. And that's something that's very difficult for any officer to hear when they've taken an oath to protect everybody, regardless of their color or their creed. And I know that's something that's affected numerous officers, and I think it was important and helpful for the officer's sake, I think, for Chief Koval to express that frustration.
Well, how do police chiefs like Chief Koval in Madison and Chief Flynn in Milwaukee, how do they walk a line? They have to, this incident is being investigated, they believe in their officers, mm-hmm. and yet there's public protest demanding that in some cases, police officers stay out of our neighborhood. I mean, so how do police officers, chiefs, respond?
Well, it's delicate. I think Chief Koval has set a very good example, and perhaps we've learned from some of the other incidents around the country, like in New York and Ferguson, where I think there was, in Ferguson, for example, I know that the police union there expressed some frustration and demanded an apology for some football players that did the hands up don't shoot thing as they walked onto the field before a game, and I think that's that's insensitive. That's not something we would ever do, and clearly explains why we took a different tact as well. But you do have to acknowledge that people have the right to express concerns and raise questions regarding the authority that is exercised on their behalf. And as frustrating as it might be for people to jump to conclusions, we have to respect the process and let the facts speak for themselves.
Well, some of those questions in the wake of these incidents, and why wasn't Tony Robinson, why wasn't Dontre Hamilton tasered, which incapacitates but doesn't kill?
Right. I can tell you, for many, many years, the WPPA has given out annual service awards for officers that go above and beyond the call of duty. And I'm also on the awards committee for the National Association of Police Organizations, their Top Cops Award. And I can tell you that, year in and year out, many, many stories of the officers that are being recognized involve a situation where a taser was attempted, the use was attempted, and it failed for a variety of reasons. If someone is having a psychotic episode, that could affect its utility. If they're under the influence of drugs or alcohol, depending on the clothing that they're wearing. And again, with any use of force, the facts dictate, the reasonableness of it. And so, it's without getting into the specifics of this case, most police policies provide that an officer it's inappropriate for them to use a taser if they don't have lethal backup. And that's, I think, the best way to answer that is that, the facts dictate, what measure of force should be used, and there are incidents in which a taser just clearly isn't appropriate.
Do most of your 10,000 members have access to a taser and have been trained in its use?
Yes.
They have.
Mm-hmm.
It was also another tragedy, the tragic shooting death of State Trooper Trevor
yeah.
Gasper.
Mm-hmm.
Leads me to ask this question. Is it more dangerous now for our Wisconsin law officers on patrol than 5-10 years ago, sir?
I believe that it is. We've already had, 32 officers that have died in the line of duty across the country so far this year. I believe that's an increase of more than 10%, looking at the same period of time from last year. Trevor Casper's tragic death is a poignant reminder, I think, of the risks and challenges that our officers face each and every day. And it's interesting that in Fond du Lac, almost 4 years ago to the day of Trevor Casper's death, was the death of another Fond du Lac police officer by the name of Craig Burkholz. Mm-hmm. And there were officers that served with him and knew him and that were involved in his incident that also responded to this one. And so it was especially a somber mood amongst those officers. And we do think it's a poignant reminder of the challenges that our officers face. And I do think it is generally becoming more dangerous to be a police officer.
Are they more worried about terrorists?
I don't know that in Wisconsin, I don't know that that's a significant concern. I mean, a lot of the cops funding over the years, the federal funding has been changed to have more of a terrorist Homeland Security kind of focus, and that money tends to go to places like New York, major urban centers. And so Wisconsin doesn't get as much of that funding, and for the very reason that I don't think it's viewed as a significant threat.
Arizona lawmakers recently put on the governor's desk a bill, and I want to check my notes to be sure I get it right, a bill that would keep secret names of officers involved in fatal shootings for 60 days. It was either yesterday or the day before that Arizona Governor Doug Ducey vetoed it. Does Wisconsin need a law like that?
No.
Why?
Well, first I want to say that I understand where the intent behind the law. As we mentioned at the outset of the interview, that officers that are involved in these situations are immediately subjected to a tremendous amount of public scrutiny. And where there's a lack of information because they just simply can't and generally don't comment, mm-hmm. The media is left to report around them and to speculate, and that can be not only terribly stressful, but sometimes it can be dangerous. And so I understand the intent to want to, protect officers. At the same time, I think, we believe that, that transparency is just so fundamentally important to maintaining the credibility that our law enforcement officers, the credibility in their jobs that they do. And so we that's not a legislation that we would...
Has anybody talked about it in our capital, Jim?
No, and we would not support that.
Okay.
We support transparency, and that's why, as one example, we supported the law last year that now mandates an independent and transparent investigation.
As somebody who's been a journalist for a few years, there's also a question whether that name would ever be kept secret, even if the law said 60 days. I mean, if there's only 64 officers on the Ferguson Police Department, it's not going to take long for somebody to leak the name of Darren Wilson, is
right,
it?
Right, right. And Wisconsin is blessed with a number of very good reporters. And I think that's just impractical. And I think it sends the wrong message. I think we need to be more transparent in the law enforcement community across the country and in Wisconsin, and not less. And so I don't think that does anything to improve the relationship between the public and the law enforcement officers that serve to protect them.
Okay, we're almost out of time, so just a couple more questions. One of them is this. 5 years ago, nobody in Wisconsin had a concealed weapon permit. I checked last week, and DOJ has issued about 245,000 of them. Mm-hmm. Do you think your officers find Wisconsin more or less safe because 245,000 of our citizens now potentially are packing?
Sure. It's a fair question, and it's not a concern that I've heard from officers as I've traveled the state, and I frequently do to interact with our officers across the state. That is not, I think, it tends to be the people that cause them the greatest danger mm-hmm. are criminals that have guns and not people who have, gone through a legal process to earn a concealed carry permit.
So there's the CCW law in Wisconsin has generally worked in the eyes of your officers.
It has not created any kind of public safety danger. I haven't heard any officer, and we've discussed it, that has expressed it, the concern that somehow it makes their jobs more dangerous.
Well, maybe a closing question to people who see the coverage of these tragic police officer-involved shootings and killings, mm-hmm. murders, mm-hmm. people died. Should they rest assured that those are being fairly investigated now, especially as a result of this new law?
Absolutely. I think law enforcement officers take their oath and their duty to do their jobs very seriously. And we had as an organization no concerns that these investigations weren't being conducted properly. And there was no evidence that anyone could provide that wasn't the case. But now with having this independent aspect and this transparent aspect, the report, assuming that the district attorney decides not to indict
yes.
Officer Kenny,
yes.
or any officer involved in this situation, that full investigative report becomes public. And
yes.
that's something that didn't exist prior to this new law as well. We think that's a good thing.
Very good. Thank you. Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Thanks for visiting Wisconsin Eye.
Thank you so much
really
for having me on.
Thank you.